This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
For Thursday, February 21st, 2013, I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Jen Chavez. The city of Portland has mandated that all city bureaus and city programs cut their budgets by 10% across the board. For its part, the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, or ONI, has worked hard to spare the Diversity and Civic Leadership, or DCL, program from drastic cuts. ONI's efforts were successful, and they announced that DCL grants were spared from recommended budget cuts. Currently, ONI is not proposing any cuts to the community of color, immigrant, and refugee organizations it funds. Today, there was an ONI budget work session at City Hall, and members of the community it serves attended to show support for the work ONI performs. Ahead of the work session, I spoke with Donita Fry, a member of the Native American Youth Family Center's Portland Youth and Elder Council, for more on the story.
What do you expect attendance for the support of NAYA and other organizations to be at the meeting? Have a lot of people showed up?
We do. I was just sharing with some of the Office of Neighborhood Involvement staff that here we are at a point in time today after being funded for 5 years through the DC Diversity and Civic Leadership Programming, that our work is finally, we've set the seed, and today it's starting to take root, that I can send out a distribution asking for community folks from the Native community to show up in solidarity to attest to the importance of funding programs like the Diversity and Civic Leadership, and through an electronic communication, we have probably 12 community members who have already showed up and more expected to come. So that's, I think, a testament about the importance of funding these types of programs.
What other community organizations out there do you feel are most essential to retain funding through the ONI?
I myself have been participating in the Budget Advisory Council meetings for several years, probably 4 years, and we do a prioritization process that weighs out what is most important to us as ONI programs and participants overall. And ultimately, I think the DCL programs, Diversity and Civic Leadership programs, have always maintained a high priority. The coalitions, neighborhood coalitions that help coordinate the work of our neighborhood associations are an integral part of the work that we do. Public safety, the crime prevention program is also one of the components that we have to juggle around, and a 10% budget cut across all of our programming is really challenging when ONI is one of the smallest funded bureaus in the city as it stands.
You have said that ONI was able to retain the DCL grants. What is on the chopping block here? What has the ONI proposed as a possible cut?
We try to avoid cutting FTE, actual people losing their jobs. So materials and expenses for the disability program were drastically reduced, as well as that for the general operations of the Office of Neighborhood Involvement. There have been cuts to the Elders in Action program, to Resolutions Northwest. We'd already been cut to the bone in previous year budget requests. Reductions. So it was really like scrubbing raw when we're trying to figure out where the important dollars going to come from. And then the small grants program, which is really a connector into the community, will be a priority when we're asking for add-back money.
What decisions will be made in this session, and what's at stake today?
My understanding is that we are showing up in solidarity to affirm to City Council how important it is to us as a community to have the Office of Neighborhood Involvement funded, and funded at a level that is more robust than it is now. That's not going to be possible this year, so we're just continuing to build participation and a presence from the community. So I think from my perspective, ultimately, we want City Council to know that funding for public involvement and for community participation is a priority. You can't have equity if you don't have public involvement. So in the way the city is going to be moving forward to do business under a new mayor and new city council, that I hope that they hear it's such a priority from us as a community to be heard.
That was Donita Fry from NYA's Portland Youth and Elder Council.
An Ashland, Oregon couple accused of selling diluted bleach as a health cure claims they are protected from prosecution by the First and the 14th Amendments to the U.S. Constitution. The defendants, Lewis Smith and Karis DeLong, claimed in court filings that federal health laws do not apply to them. They say that because they sold their product only to members of their online company, they are protected under the First Amendment as a private health care organization. Prosecutors argued last week that Smith and DeLong are not protected from prosecution simply by declaring that their operation is private instead of public. The case is currently being tried in federal court in Spokane, Washington, where their company, Project Green Life, was based before being shut down in 2011 during an FDA raid. The defendants are being charged with smuggling, conspiracy, and four counts of the interstate sale of misbranded drugs, as well as for allegedly smuggling their product's active ingredient, sodium chlorite, from Canada. The product, Miracle Mineral Supplement, or Miracle Mineral, is said to mix with citric acid to form chlorine dioxide. Chlorine dioxide is an industrial chemical which is used to bleach textiles and to disinfect wastewater. According to the FDA website, the FDA has received several reports of health injuries from consumers who were using this product.
Legislation supported by the Portland Business Alliance regarding sidewalk use in Portland has been brought forth in the Oregon House. House Bill 2963 would give cities, rather than the state, authority over regulation of public sidewalk usage. In the past, city sidewalk ordinances in Portland, also known as sit-lie laws, have been preempted by more lenient state laws on sidewalk use. Courts have challenged the constitutionality of Portland's ordinance on multiple occasions. The business community has been vocal on sidewalk rules, saying that loiterers and panhandlers drive away customers and hurt business. But homeless advocates are concerned that a new expanded city ordinance on sidewalk use would put the Portland homeless community even more at risk of being unfairly targeted by law enforcement. Local publication Street Roots has been following the story and published an article today entitled "Portland Business Alliance Goes to Salem to Change Sidewalk Laws." Today, I spoke with Street Roots Executive Director Israel Bayer for background on the story. In terms of the history of the city ordinance versus state law regarding sidewalk usage, how has the state law's authority over city rules come into play in court decisions in the recent past?
Over the years, the ordinance has been modified and procedures messaged as court cases surface. So one circuit court judge ruled in 2003 a sit-lie law unconstitutionally vague and overbroad. In 2005, an appellate judge declared it was unconstitutional because it conflicted with state law regarding disorderly conduct. In 2009, the Multnomah County Circuit Court judge came to the same conclusion that it was unconstitutional. So, you know, over the past decade, the sit-lie law, which refers to, you know, people experiencing poverty sitting or lying on public spaces or sidewalks, has basically gone in and out of the courts over a period of time, where you would have the city basically say that they wanted to have certain rules regulated against people who access public sidewalks. Oftentimes, law enforcement would target specifically poor people experiencing poverty. And ultimately, the courts would rule that they were unconstitutional. So, you know, I often refer to this debate as really a bad ping pong match between special interest groups and homeless advocates and the city itself. So it's been kind of a nightmare scenario over the last decade. I don't think it serves anybody any goodwill to continue to work on these issues when what we have currently is just fine. So.
A spokeswoman for the Portland Business Alliance told your publication that the state law needed more clarification. Do you agree with that statement, and do you think that would be achieved by passing the legislation that's been brought forth?
You know, I don't think that the law needs more clarification. I think that, you know, it's our interpretation that the Portland Business Alliance would use the current bill at the Oregon legislature to potentially target and criminalize people experiencing homelessness and to create, you know, an opportunity for them to come up with stricter laws that historically have been ruled unconstitutional.
From your point of view, do you expect this legislation to have success and be passed?
We don't know. We have no clue what electives and how electives will respond to this issue. You know, this issue specifically does not only affect Portland, but would affect people experiencing homelessness and poverty throughout the entire state of Oregon. So the same conversations that are happening in Portland are happening in Eugene and Ashland and Bend. And we feel like that, you know, it would be the Oregon legislature's responsibility to make sure that people's rights are put at the forefront of their thinking.
Do you think that there's any potential for this, if the legislation was passed, to set a precedent for other states?
You know, these kinds of laws are happening all across the United States, and it's something that we as homeless advocates constantly have to keep an eye on and constantly have to monitor, because the criminalization of the homelessness is alive and well in the United States. So it's very important for groups to be able to, you know, have a larger dialogue, create a conversation, and to combat any laws that ultimately criminalize people who live without a home.
I've been speaking with Israel Bayer, the executive director of Street Roots. This has been Jen Chavez reporting for KBOO News.
Oregon State Representative Bruce Hanna, a Republican from Roseburg, introduced four bills today. They would cut back the costs associated with the Public Employee Retirement System, or PERS. This would put Governor John Kitzhaber's proposals into effect if they're passed. House Bills 305, 6, 7, 8, and 9 would require a number of cuts to public employee retiree benefits in Oregon. First, workers would be prohibited from including unused vacation and sick leave as part of their final average salary, which is used to calculate retirement benefits. The second bill would cap the cost of living adjustment at 2% on the first $36,000 of pension income. This would not keep pace with the current rate of inflation, particularly of health care costs, and workers say they will quickly fall into debt with this plan. Third, the bills will shift the responsibility for paying the required 6% employee contribution from employers back to the workers. And finally, the bills do away with income tax reimbursements for retirees living out of state. Republicans say the cuts to PERS will be part of a larger austerity package that will cut millions of dollars from the state budget. These bills are currently under consideration in the Oregon House of Representatives. Listeners interested in contacting their state legislators can find the contact information at oregonlegislature.gov.
Three local women have taken a stand to protect an old sequoia tree in Pier Park in St. John's. Today, they stood in the way of chainsaws, despite being threatened with arrest. They are calling for people to come to Pier Park again tomorrow to help support this action. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg went to the park this morning and brings us this report.
Pier Park is a quiet park in North Portland, made up of old-growth sequoia and dug fir trees, a frisbee golf course, and winding paths through the woods. But this morning, it was the site of a confrontation between local residents and the Portland Department of Parks and Recreation. The city says that cutting a 100-year-old sequoia tree is necessary to complete the North Portland Greenway Trail. The 10-mile trail will connect the East Bank Esplanade at the Steel Bridge to Kelly Point Park in North Portland. The trail route will include a bridge over railroad tracks to connect Pier Park and Chimney Park in St. John's, and the tree is in the way of this bridge. Mark Ross with Portland Parks and Recreation says that other options were considered, but all three options would have required trees to be removed.
We're standing on top of a hill right now, and we have to get over railroad tracks where a train is passing at this very moment. If we didn't go in this spot and have to take out a tree to build this bridge, which will connect St. John's safely to Pier Park and Chimney Park, then we'd have to shore up earthen berms down where the land is lower and knock down even more trees, clusters of trees. So it's simple math. One is the fewest number of trees we could impact and build this project so it has a safe crossing and still get the project done.
Having a berm in another location, would the trees that would be cut there be younger trees?
I'm not aware. I don't know. I'm sorry.
And were the other plans that were looked at more expensive?
I don't know that either. These are the three ones that were submitted for proposals, and they all involve the best solution, which is up here on the hill.
And has there been public involvement in this process?
There has. There was a public meeting in December of 2011 where the plans were laid out.
And what was the response?
I wasn't part of that meeting. I know what happened. And then there was a meeting on Monday night with Friends of Pier Park. And in response to their passion, we decided that we would take some of this tree that's going to come down and keep it benches here, made out of it, in Pier Park. So we're repurposing it. It's not just going to be tossed away. It's going to enjoy a wonderful second life.
Local residents and activists disagree, saying that alternate routes are possible, but were not considered by the city. Chris Fountain began her one-woman protest early this morning and was later joined by two other women who all decided to risk arrest to save the tree.
I'm just trying to delay this process as long as possible so that we can continue with the wheels that we already have put in motion to stop this whole process. They need to clear the area of people that might be in danger if they start cutting, so they can't do any cutting unless I move. And I'm not going to move.
Members of Occupy St. John's were among the supporters who gathered today at Pier Park in North Portland to try to prevent the city from cutting down the tree.
But we like to be really local because we're here. We love our little St. John's.
And do you have regular meetings?
Yeah, every Wednesday at 7 p.m. at Anna Bananas on Lombard.
So people, if they hear, can get involved.
Right, and that's why I'm here this morning, because Dennis showed up last night's meeting and explained what was going on to us. They're putting this on Facebook and asking people to come.
A couple of other smaller trees were cut down today, and a city mediator arrived to try to convince the protesters to move. The activists were told by the mediator to prepare an alternate plan and are currently seeking a transportation engineer that can help them figure out how to build an alternate bridge. As of this newscast, the 100-year-old sequoia has not yet been cut down, and activists plan to return to the park tomorrow to continue to try to prevent the city from cutting down the tree. For KBOO News, I'm Jenka Soderberg.
The AARP of Oregon and the U.S. Small Business Administration are hosting free workshops this spring on the subject of starting a business, and specifically for people age 50 and older. KBOO's David Coyle has more in collaboration with the Oregon News Service.
The second half of life might mean a second career as an entrepreneur. One in four people ages 44 to 70 reports wanting to try self-employment. So the Small Business Administration and AARP Oregon have teamed up to help people 50 and older get started. The Encore Entrepreneur Business Forum is a brief introduction to all the programs and services available to encourage self-employment in Oregon, most of which are free. Robert Ducati with the SBA says workers in their 50s and beyond already have experience and expert knowledge in their fields, and wanting to be their own boss is a natural step.
There's a lot of talent out there. We see a lot of folks walk through our doors. They have a great idea. They have a great concept. They've been playing with it for years, and they really want to move forward, and they just don't know how. Well, we're the how piece.
He says the forum covers sources of funding, mentoring, technical training, and the federal procurement process. There was an overflow crowd at the forum in Portland, and others will be held this spring in Eugene and Medford. Ducati says the information is also online on the SBA.gov website. For KBOO News, I'm David Coyle.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. Stay tuned for Free Speech Radio News at 5:30, followed by Tillicum Wawa at 6, featuring Tom Ball, Vice President of the Native American Program at the University of Oregon in Eugene. At 7, it's Hard Knock Radio, news and views from a hip-hop perspective. Tomorrow's weather will be rainy, with a high near 49 degrees. Tomorrow night, we'll see continued showers and a low around 37 degrees.
It's 5:22. That means it's time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
Have you had your minimum daily requirement of nanos today? Nanomaterials, that is, manufactured or natural substances that are broken down in high-tech facilities to be teensy-tiny, molecule-sized particles. Don't look for them on the ingredient list of food packages, because the big corporate processors of our edibles don't want us to know that their goodies include these minuscule, mysterious things that, when ingested, go to places in the body that regular foodstuffs don't directly enter, such as straight into your cells. There's been precious little research on the human health impacts of nanos, though studies have shown them having unpleasant effects on mice. Also, our food regulators have flatly and ominously said they don't have enough information even to evaluate the safety of nanomaterials. So why are they popping up in processed foodstuffs? No one is talking, except a few anonymous food manufacturers who express enthusiasm for the ability for the whatever they are to make processed foods seem creamier and to brighten food colors. A watchdog group called As You Sow sent a survey to 2,500 food manufacturers asking about their use of nanos. A whopping 26 responded, only 14 of which claimed not to use the things. The group ran its own test of 10 varieties of powdered donuts, finding that the sweet concoctions of Hostess Brands and Dunkin' Donuts had products containing a nano called titanium dioxide. What benefit does it offer? It makes white substances brighter. This is Jim Hightower saying, hello. An unknown number of corporate food profiteers are pumping an unknown amount of unknown nanomaterials straight into our cells, having an unknown impact on our health, for no better reason than to enhance the cosmetics of their products. To fight the madness, go to asyousow.org.
Hightower's commentary is brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown. From Wall Street to Washington, this monthly newsletter reveals who's doing what to whom and why. Check it out, hightowerlowdown.org.
On Tuesday, former congressional candidate David Gill from Illinois' 13th District joined with the watchdog group Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, or CREW, to file a civil suit against the Internal Revenue Service. A dark money group called the American Action Network, or AAN, spent more than $1 million on negative ads in 2012. Accusing the IRS of creating a loophole that has allowed groups like AAN to flourish, the civil suit alleges that Gill suffered economic harm and harm to his reputation as a result of, quote, false and misleading, unquote, ads financed by AAN. AAN is a nonprofit organized as a 501c4, or social welfare organization. It does not normally disclose its donors, but the group is known to have received funding in the past from the insurance company Aetna and the Pharmaceutical Researchers and Manufacturers of America. The suit claims that the public was unaware that those groups sought Gill's defeat because of his support for a single-payer national health care plan. CREW's arguments focus on the difference between federal law, which states that nonprofits organized as a 501c4 must operate, quote, exclusively for purposes beneficial to the community as a whole, end quote, and IRS regulations, which allow groups, quote, primarily engaged in social welfare, end quote, to have 501c4 status.
A federal grand jury has indicted former officials of Peanut Corporation of America, or PCA, in connection with a 2009 outbreak of salmonella from tainted peanut products. Over 700 people became sick, as many as 9 people were killed by the salmonella outbreak. PCA recalled 2,100 products following the outbreak. But an FDA investigation into their facility revealed that the PCA knowingly sold salmonella-tainted peanuts and peanut products to customers. According to Stuart DeLary, Principal Deputy Assistant Attorney General, some previous officials at PCA fashioned fake lab results in order to convince customers that their products contained no salmonella. The labs themselves were found to be unsanitary. Stuart Parnell and Michael Parnell, former president and vice president of PCA, respectively, and Samuel Lightsey, plant operations manager, are facing charges of conspiracy, mail and wire fraud, and introduction of adulterated and misbranded food into interstate commerce. Mary Wilkerson, the plant's quality insurance manager, and Stuart Parnell are being charged with obstruction of justice.
A new bill has been proposed that would keep incarcerated children out of solitary confinement in Florida. The Youth in Solitary Confinement Reduction Act would limit the total amount of time a youth could be placed in solitary confinement and require more frequent breaks from isolation and access to psychological oversight. Under current conditions, children are being isolated for days, weeks, and sometimes months without human contact, opportunity to exercise, or educational services. This type of isolation can be detrimental to the psychological development of children, according to a study put out jointly by Human Rights Watch and the American Civil Liberties Union. The study says 95,000 children were incarcerated in the U.S. in 2011, and the use of solitary confinement for child prisoners is widespread throughout the country. Critics of solitary confinement for children say that it violates both international human rights laws as well as the U.S. Constitution. If passed, the legislation will go into effect July 1st of this year.
A letter from an inmate at Snake River Correctional Institute, located in Ontario, Oregon, on the Idaho border, alleges abuse and neglect by guards directed at prisoner Kevin Rashid Johnson. Johnson is a prison organizer and one of the founders of the prison chapter of the New African Black Panther Party. He is also the author of Defying the Tomb, a collection of correspondence with another inmate on topics such as prison solidarity and revolutionary theory. He has spent most of his adult life in prison, including 17 years of solitary confinement in Virginia prisons. There was at least one incident of abuse in December 2011 when a portion of his hair was ripped out by the roots by a guard. He was transferred to the Oregon State Penitentiary last March and more recently to the Snake River facility known as Cowboy Country to both inmates and staff there. The letter circulated today is from Johnson's cellmate, and it says that, quote, "On January 31st, they put something in his food that made him crazy," end quote. The letter says that in the following days, Johnson ingested 30 unidentified pills and 3 razor blades, and then stopped eating and drinking and began urinating blood, losing weight, and passing out. Prison staff, according to the letter, are saying he's the one who won't eat or drink, so they're not helping him at all. KBOO Radio tried to contact multiple staff members at the Snake River Correctional Institute and the Oregon Department of Corrections, but our calls have not been returned.
Lawyers representing 19-year-old Ismail Abdellah have filed an excessive force claim against the Seattle Police Department for $500,000. The claim regards an August 2nd incident last year in which Abdellah's lawyers say the police used inappropriate force and displayed threatening behavior against their client. The incident came just days after a settlement between the Seattle Police Department and the U.S. Department of Justice to address federal findings of excessive force and bias by the department. Today I spoke with Sean Gillespie, one of the lawyers representing Mr. Abdellah, for more details on the case. What actions by the police against your client are evidenced on video?
On video, we have Mr. Abdellah, our client, is in a park in South Seattle, and Officer Clayton Powell is trying to pick a fight with it. He's yelling at him. He's pushing him. He's getting within a few inches of his face. And ultimately, he shoves Mr. Abdullah very hard. After that, he arrests Mr. Abdullah. He takes him to the precinct. And later, there is in the cell video of Officer Powell threatening Mr. Abdullah. And it's all related to Officer Powell's inappropriate behavior at the park. He's effectively telling him, I don't want you talking about this anymore. Those are extremely troubling behaviors by Officer Powell. Mr. Abdullah was never charged with anything. He was never actually suspected of anything other than being a target of Officer Powell. And to arrest him inappropriately and then threaten him once he's in custody it just can't happen. We can't let those things stand.
How does this fit into federal findings around the same time regarding use of excessive force by the Seattle Police Department?
Well, this is simply another behavior from a small group of officers who don't have respect for the rights of their citizens. Mr. Abdullah was simply observing the police do their work. Officer Powell was ostensibly there to control the scene, and he did the very opposite. He let the scene get out of control, and most cops do a good job. And Mr. Powell is in a small subset of people who have not been checked by their own department and who have been allowed to go out there and mistreat people.
Following the federal reports of use of excessive force by the department, what reforms that would possibly result from that would you say are the most necessary or essential in reducing cases like the one of your client?
With certain officers, they might just not have the skills, and they need to be trained better. They need to be conditioned to think about the people that they're policing and think about their rights and how to respect them. And then in other cases, it might be that a particular person just isn't fit for duty and they need to be looking hard at their candidates before they hire them. And so